Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talked to George Eaton and Raphael Baer about the year in review and forced them to make some predictions for 2014. Then Ian Steadman and I talk about memes along with our new recruit, Sean Anderson. I'm joined by Raphael Baer, our political editor, and George Eaton, editor of The Staggers, to discuss the year in review. So, George, there's been a lot of kind of chatter this morning about the fact that the polls have shifted all over the place in the course of the year, but essentially Labour are pretty much back where they started, about 6 points ahead, mostly.
Yeah, they have a small but stubborn lead, and the big point in their favour is still all those Lib Dems who went over in 2010. Some of them have gone back, but not enough for the Tories to close the gap, and not enough of their supporters have come back from UKIP.
Plus their structural advantage due to the fact the way the boundary changes work.
Absolutely.
They have to be 7 points ahead, the Conservatives?
Yeah, they have to be 7 points ahead to get a majority.
And Raph, you've written in your column this week about the idea that both Cameron and also Miliband are kind of still in both in different ways in the shadows of previous leaders of their parties.
Yes, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, looking back over the year, the biggest event for the Tories in many ways will have been the death of Margaret Thatcher. And it was a very revealing moment. It was a very sad moment for Conservatives who idolise the Thatcher legacy. I think my own view is that the Tories sort of missed an opportunity there to reach out to quite significant numbers of people who don't idolise the Thatcher legacy. And it was very revealing, I think, that David Cameron at that time didn't feel able to really find any fault at all with the 1980s and what Margaret Thatcher had done. I think if he'd been in a stronger position in his party, if he had a clearer identity that other Tories could get behind, he would have been able to say, yes, we cherish this great woman's legacy, but also we recognise that there are communities, areas where the industrial base was hollowed out. There are whole groups of people who sort of see Margaret Thatcher as essentially callous and vindictive as a figure in British public life, and say, OK, we sort of understand where you're coming from and we're a bit sorry about that. And without that, really, the Tories will never get through to those people that, going back to what George was saying, are sort of culturally inoculated against ever putting a cross next to the name of a Tory candidate. And that's why the Tories didn't get a majority in 2010. And that's why it really looks like they're not going to get a majority in 2015. And so he missed that chance. And then very quickly, I think, not obviously on the same scale because Tony Blair is still alive, but it is remarkable how much of Labour's year was the politics of the Labour Party were conducted in this constant dialogue with how Blairite are you or aren't you, should you be, shouldn't you be. And that really has run right up till the reshuffle, and then in the analysis of the reshuffle, Ed promoting lots of people who could be seen as Milibandites. It's all still so desperately trying to make an accommodation with the past, and both leaders really badly need to start talking about the future more.
So this is this idea of that as a generation of 2010ers, really, that both parties are trying to bring on because they're kind of untainted by the
clean skins who don't have, on the Labour side, they're not sort of scarred by the very personal vendettas. I mean, the problem with the Labour ranks of pre-2010 is you'll have people who are briefed against, you have very personal animosities relating to the whole Blair-Brown civil war. The 2010ers less so. So that's obviously an advantage if they look fresh and young and can get behind Ed
Miliband. But the interesting thing about the Tory 2010ers is that some of those are kind of quite explicitly neo-Thatcherite. They're kind of the Britannia Unchained group of Kwasi Kwarteng, Priti Patel, those kind of people. So is that... Oh, is Cameron more a hiatus?
The interesting thing there, and George will probably have some thoughts about this, that they are... They don't sit... The one thing about Tory 2010ers is they don't naturally sit between the sort of modernisers and the traditionalists, because a lot of them are socially very liberal and voted in favour of gay marriage, but they are ideologically zealously anti-state. So they are the sort of turbo Thatcherism, but much more in tune with some of the sort of 21st century cultural social mores of modern Britain. They're not angry, red-faced, white-haired men in red braces and pinstripe shirts.
Which is more electorally where the country is, right, George?
Yeah, it is socially. I mean, in that reforms like gay marriage are accepted and then quickly become part of the culture. But the country certainly isn't in a libertarian position on the economy. People fear private companies, unregulated markets a lot more than they do the state. And I'm forever pointing out to people that actually the public are to the left of Miliband on some of these issues. They want the railways renationalised. They want the energy utility companies renationalised. They want maybe a 60% top rate of tax, not just a 50% one. And that's the public in some ways have always been to the left of where so most conservatives imagine them to be, but certainly in the wake of the financial crisis, they are much more sceptical of the market than they were before, and that's not a surprise.
And you see even papers like The Mail do love a bit of banker bashing.
Yes.
I mean, that is now a kind of accepted category of somebody that, just as much as, you know, you might deride the single mother, the kind of fat cat banker is now firmly in their sights. Before we move on to asking you for a couple of predictions, I just want to talk generally. There's just been this big narrative that's been dominated now for maybe 3 months since Miliband's conference speech and the energy price freeze about this kind of, the Tories were winning the argument on the macro economy, the big thing, the deficit, the debt. And then, but Labour are the party that the polls kind of come across, you know, you are on the side of people like me. Do you think that narrative will hold into next year, or do you think that's going to change either of you?
I think it is very, very difficult for the Tories to claw some of that back. I think their strongest claim is to be slightly heartless accountants who are just whipping the country into shape because, God damn it, that's what it needs. But they won't. So they will never be. There's never going to be affection or compassion there. I still think they can do okay on that if Labour, you know, fall apart for whatever reason. But just because of the sort of the tax cut for millionaires, the cabinet of millionaires, there's something of now, I think Cameron and Osborne are so associated with representing moneyed elitism that they will never be sort of authentically of the people they're claiming to represent. I don't think that stops them from possibly forming another government, but I think it stops them from being seen as normal people.
And where, George, does this leave the Lib Dems and their kind of electoral strategy? Are they still the kind of, you know, the chaser that you take to dilute whatever the other two parties are offering? Is that still where they're positioning themselves?
Well, they are trying to position themselves as the centrist party. So those of you who don't trust Labour on the economy and those of you who think the Conservatives are just for the rich, vote for us. And they have this, you know, this mantra, fair society and strong economy. I don't think that is going to sort of bring back the voters they've lost to Labour. I don't think it's going to win them any new voters. Their best hope really is fighting the election as 57 by-elections. They point out, you know, where they, and Eastleigh was of course the big example of this in this year, you know, where they have local candidate, where they have lots of councillors, where they're dug in, where the Tories have lost votes to UKIP, they can still win. And in fact, in their more optimistic moments, they say, well, you know, in some seats the Tories won narrowly in 2010. Could we leapfrog them because UKIP have surged? And of course, if Zach Goldsmith resigns over Heathrow, which I don't think he will actually, at least not before the election, that would be quite a good test of that.
Okay, well, I'm going to now do a little segment I like to call Raph and George Give Me Hostages to Fortune, where I ask you, much as we did on the Sunday Politics, about your predictions for next year. So first off, will Scotland be independent by this time next year?
No.
No, and I think it'll be at least a double-digit defeat.
Oh, confident. Who will come top in the EU?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Elections in the summer.
Labour, because of the turnout in the county council, local elections on the same day, which were in quite Labour urban areas.
Labour, UKIP second.
See, this is, I already said UKIP on this, because I think that lots of Tory voters will decide to have their little protest vote against, and then come back, and then probably come
Labour
back.
Labour will get out the vote, it's too important.
Okay, well there we go, this is going to be, a very exciting May. It's, well, mildly exciting May. Who will be ahead in the polls this time next year?
Best guide to the near future is the recent past. It'll be the same, it's been the same all the way through.
Still 6 points, Labour 6 points ahead.
Very little change, 4 to 6 points.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay. And finally, who will leave the cabinet this year?
William Hague.
Ooh, out of left field.
I made that up. I have no idea.
Gone.
I'm going to say.
It's always Lib Dem. Let's face it. Isn't it?
I'm going to say Jeremy Hunt actually, because the NHS is what is giving people in Downing Street sleepless nights.
Yeah, that's not bad.
And if someone's going to have to take the flak, it will be the health secretary.
I'm going to pick in Duncan Smith, more out of hope than expectation. And on that note, happy Christmas, George and Renov.
And to you.
Thank you.
I'm joined by Ian Steadman and our new recruit, Sean Anderson, to talk about memes. Okay, Ian, start me from the very, very beginning. What is a meme?
A meme is kind of like, well, we know that living things have genes. And Richard Dawkins, who you may have heard of, is a sort of prominent biology scientist man.
I hear they like him on the internet.
They love him on the internet. And he loves them very much. And he coined this term meme in the 70s. I don't know exactly which year, but it was the book The Selfish Gene. And it's the idea that ideas propagate and spread and interact and intermarry and change in the same way that genes do.
And there are units of information, essentially, yeah, that can be passed around and traded around in the same way that genes can. Okay, so the reason we're having this conversation is because I've had to sit on that desk with people doing Doge me for about a month. To anybody who is, you know, a normal person, can you explain what is Doge?
What is Doge?
What is Doge?
It's very funny is what it is, and I don't know why. Like most memes, it's a very silly thing. It's an image of a Shibu, which is a type of Japanese sort of husky dog that is looking at the camera in a funny way.
It doesn't look very clever, I think that's what's to say. Yeah. It looks like naive and trusting and a bit fat and not very...
But also curious, I think.
Yeah.
And it's just got a cute little face that you kind of want to pinch the cheeks on, and people put funny words around it in Comic Sans, brightly coloured Comic Sans font, like wow, very meme, much
such
Doge,
meme.
Such yeah. Doge. That's Doge, and it makes me feel like an idiot for finding it funny, because now I'm saying it out loud, and it just embarrasses myself.
Quite a lot of the last month laughing at a picture of a slightly stupid looking dog with some misspelled Comic
Sans. More than most things that are meant to be deliberately funny, like, you know. Comedians spend hours trying to come up with jokes and stuff, and I don't laugh at that anywhere near as much as that stupid dog.
Right. It could almost be part of the definition as soon as you start to think about what a meme is, it all falls apart, and you're like,
yeah, what have
sense.
I done? Sean, do you have a favourite meme?
My favourite meme is, in fact, Richard Dawkins again, standing in front of an audience of some famous people and just saying memes over and over again.
So he gave this really kind of crazy talk earlier in the show where he gave quite, I don't know, it was a really long setup where he gave quite an interesting but sort of slightly dry talk for about 6 minutes. And then he suddenly wandered off stage, wandered back on with like an electric clarinet or something.
Oh, it's
and
got
then started
a name.
Showing videos of like an owl with lasers coming out of its eyes and his own head splitting open and stuff like that. Which, you know, he is Richard Dawkins. He did invent memes. That's kind of... Got him allowed, I guess.
King of the memes.
But I guess the point about memes is that, I mean, I find them really interesting as part of this kind of outgrowth of internet culture. So They're a way for people who might or not otherwise have a lot in common to signal a kind of group membership. So everybody knows, like, what is it? It's actual advice mallard, for example, which is a picture of a duck that's very popular on Reddit with something like, you know, went to open cupboard, stuff fell on me.
Yeah.
And then everybody
goes... Confession bear, where it's a picture of a bear and people write confessions over the top of it. That's it. I mean, it's just very
nice
strange.
Nice guy boss and stuff like that. So it's a way of people sharing, like you say, very small units of information, like only maybe a sentence or two, in a way that
it's like
the whole community accepts.
It's like society-wide in-jokes. It's like in-jokes that we're all in on. They're just bizarre things that, like, you know, in-jokes don't really make sense a lot of the time and can be a bit bizarre, but they just make sense and they're funny because you and your friends happen to be at a certain place in a certain time and experience the same things, so it makes sense. We as a society have created these ridiculous in-jokes that don't make sense, but we still like them.
You say we as a society, but if you go home, either of you, to your parents or whoever, your loved ones, this Christmas, and you go, wow, such Christmas, many presents.
They won't
very
get
happy.
That, but they're still even though my parents are pretty inept when it comes to the internet, I mean, my dad basically plays Freecell on the computer, and that's all he does. I could still probably explain it to them in less than 30 seconds, and they don't understand it. They probably understand it as like, oh, it's like in the 80s when we were all laughing at Where's the Beef? It's that kind of thing.
But I guess the other thing that's interesting is that so many of these are kind of community-driven. I mean, you're probably both too young, but I remember the horrible times of the Budweiser advert and the what's that?
I remember the Budweiser
advert. Oh, yeah, all right. I don't know, you're probably too young to drink then. This is a really horrible story. But they were, I feel like, in that kind of... I guess we've had the Go Compare horror and the Meerkat. But it does feel to me very much like it used to be something that was driven by particularly by adverts and by big brands. And it's much harder to do that now. You know, Reddit requires a translation guide, essentially, if you just stumbled in from Mars to do it.
Well, I mean, one of my favourite things on Twitter this year has been everyday sexism becoming this really popular thing. It's almost a common phrase now in Britain to just say, like, oh, you know, hashtag everyday sexism.
Yeah, and there's lots of kind of spin-offs from that as well. There's kind of, there's everyday racism, everyday ableism, everyday victim blaming. But that's quite interesting because that's kind of going the other way around. So that's almost now becoming a brand. And actually, people can use that to point out a lot of stuff that it wasn't originally used
for.
Someone should make t-shirts.
We're still at a stage where I think when someone says hashtag something out loud, there's kind of people go, oh, Jesus. But you can feel it changing. People aren't as judgmental of that as they were.
No, I know. That's
going to become a common thing.
There's a BuzzFeed post today about all the things that Nathan Barley predicted and how they've come true. And I feel that they are inexorably moving closer towards that state. Ian, best meme of the year?
Oh, it's Doge.
You're just saying that. This is like the poll where people just say the last thing. Like, they go, who's the best doctor? And they just name the last one because it's all they can remember.
It's not even the last one. It genuinely is the best one this year. I tend not to laugh at a lot of stupid, especially Reddit ones, which I just don't really get. But Doge genuinely makes me laugh. I think it's superior to lolcats in every way, which is controversial, but lolcats was rubbish, always. So.
But the horrible thing about that is that there's a whole rewriting of, like, the Bible in lolcats, and now we're going to have inevitably next year, we'll have the Doge works of Shakespeare, the Doge of Venice.
Yeah.
It's Doge that ends the Doge. It's just going to go, well, actually, that would be nice, the Doge of Venice. That would bring it full circle back round to a literary theme.
Much holy.
Don't tweet that. I'm saving that. Thank you very much, Ian and Sean. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil for the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.